This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 218, was recorded on May 7th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to healthcare workers worldwide, the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, and is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Economic cycles guru Lakshman Achuthan, founder of the Economic Cycles Research Institute, ECRI, will join me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss what economic cycles teach us about recessions, which are driven by exogenous shock events, and what we might expect the recovery from the COVID-19 recession to look like. We'll also discuss longer-term cycles, including the shift from secular deflation to secular inflation or stagflation, and the outlook for U.S.-China relations after the crisis. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when we'll take another deep dive into the crude oil market and discuss the epic reversal in WTI time spreads, what it means for both on-land and floating storage, as well as the price outlook for next week's options expiration.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, listeners, we'll have a detailed update of the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis in our post-game segment after the feature interview. Now, Eric, let's dive into that S&P 500. No sooner did we finish recording last week, did that Friday, the S&P dive to the downside. And it's been more or less all week retracing some of that. We're about 2876 on the SPOOS futures right now. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I think the really important signal is we only spent one day or so above that 2930 Fibonacci retracement level. That's a 61.8% retrace. That's what causes me to say, I think this is a bear market rally. I think that 61.8 Fib was the top. We actually traded intraday quite a few points above that, but ended up, I think, only one close over that level. It's been all downhill since. Now, we're bouncing now. I shouldn't say it's all downhill, but we're still staying below 2900. If we saw a daily close above 2930, that would make me think, okay, maybe there's still one last hurrah. We're going to get that test of 3000 before this is over. But right now, my base case is it's probably over and done with. In some ways, I kind of regret not shorting it when I had the chance. I really do think it's a bear market rally. But, and you know, we had Charlie McElligott this week. You know, Charlie usually is a very, very good analyst, but usually all of his calls are really about what's going on with flow, you know, in the next 24 hours. He's a very short-term, what's happening right now in the market kind of guy. He's making a longer-term call that he's saying he thinks that the outlook for the rest of the summer is down for the S&P, not up. So I do think that we've probably already seen the top of the bear market rally. If not, maybe there's one more push up to 3,000, but I doubt that. The reason that I didn't trade it again is just because, first of all, I've had, you know, my focus has been on the oil market and I'm spending all of my time there. I don't really have time for this. But also because I just see that the Fed has very clearly shown its hands. They want to bail out financial markets. They want to rescue the stock market. It's an election year. President Trump doesn't want to see the stock market go down. He's going to assert every bit of pressure that he can. So, you know, betting on a collapse of the S&P, in any normal market, I would say we got to see new lows below 2174. That was the bear market rally. The bottom is still yet to come. I'm not going to make that call on this market just because I see too much intervention risk from the federal government. Just, you know, look at what they did with junk bonds and so forth. So that's my take, but, you know, we could be wrong. We'll see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, which is pivoting off the 100 handle up and down. But it really, the dollar's done nothing wrong, but nothing right. I mean, it's just chopping around here. Do you still think this resolves itself to the upside?
Well, Patrick, as we've said for the last several weeks, we're in this consolidation pattern between 99 and 101. We need to see a break out of that range before we have any clear signal. You can certainly make the argument that we've now seen a triple bottom with, I guess it was March 30th, approximately April 14th, 15th in there somewhere. And then just this last week, those tests of 99 or even down to 98.50 on the first one. Was that a triple bottom? Is it all uphill from here? Really, the big tests for the bull case, first, we got to get through 101 on a daily closing basis. We've been consolidating for well over a month now and haven't done it. So until we get over 101, I don't think there's any real signal in this market. Once we do see that, then the big test is 104. If we can see a closing print over 104, then I really think the move higher is on. For now, we're consolidating sideways. We'll wait and see what the market tells us.
So, Eric, you warned me off the air that you had so much to say about crude oil this week that we would take up most of the post-game segment. But how about giving our listeners just a quick executive summary for now, and then we'll continue the conversation in the post-game.
Patrick, let's start with inventory. The crude oil build nationally was 4.6 million barrels. That pales, I mean, normally that would be a big build, but compared to the last several weeks, that just pales in magnitude. Little bit misleading there, because normally we don't see any action on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is the government's piggy bank for crude oil. There was a 1.7 million barrel build on the SPR. So if you add the SPR and the non-SPR numbers together, you get 6.3 instead of 4.6. That's still much smaller than the 15 million barrel build that we saw 2 or 3 weeks ago. Cushing, Oklahoma, meanwhile, building 2.1 million barrels. In normal times, that would be considered a big build, but it's a very small build compared to the 5 million plus that we were seeing a few weeks ago. And I just saw today on Thursday that Genscape reported, as of this week, they do some look-ahead reporting using infrared cameras to survey the tank farms in Cushing, Oklahoma. It looks like we may see the drawdown that I've been predicting on Cushing inventories coming in next week's report. Needless to say, there's a big question of what this means. On the face of it, it seems to suggest that the storage crisis is over and it's all getting better. There's another way to interpret this. We talked about that last week. It's going to really take a fair amount of time to get into the nuances of all of what this could mean. Finishing the inventory report, gasoline was the only drawdown, 3.2 million barrels there. Distillates, though, building 9.5 million barrels. U.S. production ticking down a couple hundred thousand barrels to 11.9 million barrels. From everything I'm hearing, the rate of shut-ins is faster than that. I suspect it ticked down more than that, and that's a high estimate. The big question, though, Patrick, is, okay, how do we interpret this data? Certainly, the front-month price has been rallying, surprising a lot of people, getting all the way up to $27 or almost $27 earlier today. The short executive summary is I think there's a good argument that today may have been the top of a rally and that we may be headed back down. But it depends on some fairly nuanced considerations that are going to take the whole post game. So let's save the rest of the conversation for after the feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because everything looked, even this morning, like it was just more of the same and flat. But in the last couple hours, right before we started recording, that was a pretty clear surge higher, almost $40 up to about the 1727 on the futures. What's your take on all this? Do you think we're going to finally break out?
Well, it's depressing, frankly. You know, as a gold bull, which I definitely am extremely bullish on gold long term, you know, what we gold bulls should wish for is a major technical correction so that we can buy some more gold on the cheap. And until today, it looked like maybe we were going to see what arguably is either a wedge or a descending triangle pattern, maybe had a chance of resolving to the downside and starting a correction lower. I was excited to maybe buy some cheaper gold to add to my existing fairly sizable position. Unfortunately, we saw today's move looks like an upside resolution to that descending triangle pattern. The big test will be to see if we get to new cycle highs above 1788, which was the recent high that we saw, what was it, back in the beginning of April sometime, or the middle of April. So it remains to be seen what happens. You know, clearly you want to own gold. The fundamentals couldn't be better. I don't think here now is the time to be using leverage to really, really, you know, load up the truck, so to speak. I'm waiting for some kind of significant technical correction before adding leverage to my existing long position, which is already substantial. So I'm hoping for lower prices. And of course, the fundamentals are so strong, it seems like it's not cooperating with me right now. We'll see what happens.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because we got a little bit of a pop in yields on that heavy issuance that happened the other day. And yet here we find ourselves once again with the yields pressing back down. We're trading at our spot 6.2 right now at the time of recording. What's your take on all this?
Well, Patrick, as I've said for the last several weeks, I don't really have a short-term view on where rates are headed. What I'm trying to focus on is asking our feature interview guests to comment on the transformation that I'm convinced is in process. We've had this just secular trend because of deflation toward lower and lower Treasury yields, as we discussed last week with Dr. Lacey Hunt. Someday, somehow, I'm convinced we're going to get to an inflationary or stagflationary macro backdrop. How do we get there, and what is it going to mean for Treasury yields along the way? I'm really thinking about that big picture and trying to form that worldview. I'll ask Lakshman Achuthan that question as we get into today's feature interview.
So, Eric, this week's feature interview guest is ECRI founder Lakshman Achuthan. Why did we invite Locke back as this week's guest?
Well, Locke is Mr. Cycles, and it occurred to me, okay, you know, how do you even think about which cycles to look at? You know, recession cycles, economic cycles, pandemic cycles. I got to believe that there's some insight. So I wanted to get Mr. Cycles himself back to kind of comment on this. And I also really wanted to ask him from a cycles perspective about this question of the secular trend shift that I'm convinced is coming, I just don't know when, from deflation to inflation and what it's going to mean for the economy. So super guy, really looking forward to this interview. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Locke is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lakshman Achuthan, founder of the Economic Cycles Research Institute. Locke has prepared a terrific slide deck to accompany today's interview. I encourage you to download it. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't yet registered a free account at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads, just above Locke's picture on the homepage. Locke, it's great to have you back on the show. Needless to say, you are Mr. Economic Cycles. Your whole career has focused on economic cycles. I'm at a loss here as to even where to start, because how does a cycles guy look at the current situation? Do you look at the virus cycle of what happened in the 1918 Spanish flu, or do you look at this in terms of what we know about economic cycles affecting recessions, which we're clearly in now, or some other way? How do you even approach this?
Well, thank you for having me, Eric. And it's an amazing cycle to be experiencing here. From a research point of view, it's certainly brutal recession and cycle to be experiencing as a person and, you know, citizen of the world here. Look, it's not one or the other. It is a combination of things. Looking at it through a cyclical lens, looking at it through, in this case, a virus lens. There have been other shocks over the centuries that have interacted with cycles. You know, up front, it's important, I think, to understand some of our foundational kind of approach to cycles at ECRI. And I'm going to put words in the consensus view for a minute and just say, you know, there are a lot of observers out there who, when a recession hits, say, you know, it was not really foreseeable because there was this, you know, shock, an unpredictable shock that occurred, in this case, the virus. And that's what causes cycles. And what we found over, as you were alluding to, you know, my whole entire career, but really, you know, my mentors and my mentors' mentors' careers of looking at cycles over a century of looking at U.S. cycles and even international cycles, is that recessions come out of, you know, an endogenous, an inherent cycle that occurs inside of a free market-oriented economy, combining with a shock. And the shock doesn't necessarily have to be really big. It can be a relatively small shock at the right time, at a time of vulnerability in the economic cycle. And then there can be times when you're less vulnerable, but there's a huge shock that is also recessionary. So it's really the combination of what's going on in the economic cycle and the timing of when these shocks are hitting. Are they hitting at times when there is some vulnerability? Now, in the current case, we literally, you know, flicked a switch and said we're shutting down the economy. So you can, by edict, create a recession. You can flick a switch and say, okay, everybody stop. You're not allowed to do anything. And as a result, activity is going to collapse and you will have a recession. Now, the trick, the problem, the issue at hand, and we'll get into this, is that by flicking that switch back up, it doesn't necessarily mean, okay, here's a recovery or a sustainable recovery that's going to, as in past recoveries from recessions, kind of be something that can really persist in a healthier way. And so I think we look both at what's going on in the endogenous business cycle that we see in free market-oriented economies everywhere, and how is that interacting with shocks? And in this case, you know, it's obviously one for the history books. This is a doozy. You've heard all of the descriptions of it being record-breaking on so many different levels, and that is all true.
Let's go ahead and take a look at your slide deck. You talk about the three Ds, referring to how you think about the dimensions, if you will, of recessions. Why don't we get into that discussion?
Yeah. So is it a recession? Is it a bad recession? Is it a depression? You know, what does it all mean? Right? And really, a recession is a contraction when the level of activity is falling, measured by output, income, employment, and sales, big, very broad aggregate measures of economic activity. This is a brutal recession. But in one respect, actually, it may not be kind of as bad as feared. And to understand why, I could kind of have it both ways there for a moment. You need to really understand how a recession's severity is measured. And we look at something called the three Ds, as in dog. The depth of the recession, the diffusion of the recession, and the duration of the recession. Now, in terms of depth, this recession is extraordinarily deep. You know, well over 30 million people have filed for jobless claims. You're kind of blowing out the jobs that were lost over 2 years during the Great Recession, just for some comparison. And it's far from over. You know, we're going to see some kind of jaw-dropping job losses in the upcoming jobs report. And without a doubt, this is a very deep recession. The GDP is going to plunge in Q2. You know, who knows exactly how far. These are going to be big numbers. But a recession is not really just a statistic. It's a vicious cycle with declines in one of these measures, like output, triggering the job losses, triggering or pushing down incomes, and therefore pulling down sales, which then feeds back into even weaker output. And so it's the cascading declines that are integral to the second D of how you measure the severity of a recession, and that's diffusion. How is it spreading across the economy? Like pretty much like wildfire during a recession, and it cascades from industry to industry and from even region to region in the country. There's really no stone that gets left untouched there. And so in terms of diffusion also, this recession is very severe. It's hard to find pockets of the economy that are unaffected. But on the third D, duration, this recession could be among the shortest on record. And here's why. With economic activity plunging so deeply, even a slow or partial opening up of the economy can lift activity off of these extreme lows. So if a gradual opening up of the economy begins soon, it's plausible that the recession would technically end by summertime. And if so, this recession would have lasted, you know, around a half a year. And that's a, like if we look to the last recession, the Great Recession, was a year and a half long. So it would just be, you know, some one third of that in terms of duration. So that's kind of what we're experiencing right now in terms of the technical measures of recession.
Okay, I just want to push back a little bit on the duration. I see a technical argument that if you go deep enough, any recovery could technically qualify as pulling you out of that condition of recession, but it doesn't get you back to where you were when you started. And it seems to me that there's a long way to go to get back to where we were pre-crisis. So if we say that the duration of the technical recession condition, when the formal definition of recession of consecutive quarters and of GDP growth and so forth, it's over because we went from just scary, horrific, bad GDP to only modestly horrific, bad GDP. Well, okay, it increased, and so therefore we're out of the recession technically, but we're still in bad shape. So are there other cycles or other analogs that we should look to for where things got so bad that even the recovery felt worse than the average recession does?
Sure. You don't even have to look that far back. I mean, you might look at 01 to 03, the early part of this century, and the recovery out of that recession was pretty wobbly for an extended period of time. So I would just say you don't even have to push back. I'm not going to argue with you on this point at all. Just because the recession is relatively brief, because there was an expansion off of the very, very low readings, it, in no way am I saying that we're going back to anything near where we were in short order. Okay, the recovery begins when that vicious cycle of pushing down jobs, pushing down income, pushing down sales, runs its course. And it begins to, the key is, you know, can it begin a virtuous cycle where some pop in demand increases production, employment, incomes, and therefore further demand growth? That is a critical question about under what conditions can that happen going forward. And as I was saying earlier, you can't just flip a switch and make that occur, right? We can have states and perhaps much of the country say, oh, okay, it's okay to go outside and it's okay to go around and start kind of reclaiming your lives. But it's only when the virtuous cycle takes hold that we're going to see some sort of more persistent recovery or expansion. That's an open question. That's where the leading indexes really come into play. I mean, you can, you know, said another way, you can force a recession, you can mandate one, which is what happened, but you cannot force a recovery. Now, every analyst out there is focused on the epidemiology, on when effective therapeutics will become widely available and when different governors and mayors are going to allow schools and businesses to open up. But the beginning and the end of this recession are not symmetric. It's not flipping a switch. You know, it's like I was trying to think of different analogies, and this is going to be a little tortured, but I was just thinking of cars because I've been at home with my car. Now, if you drive home, you switch off the engine and you leave the car in the driveway through a bitterly cold winter. You know, I got sick. I didn't want to go outside. I just left it there. And I couldn't get out of the house for a lot of weeks. So it's just sitting there. You don't want to do that with your car, but sometimes that might happen. Now, I have an older car, and, you know, it'll have an iced up carburetor. Maybe the water in the fuel lines has gotten in the fuel lines and frozen up. You know, the oil is sticky. The battery's drained, all this stuff. It's not that I'm not going to be able to drive that car again. I will. I'll fix it up. I'll work on it. But I have no misconception that it's just going to start right up and I'm going to buzz off without doing anything. I know it's going to take some time and some work and some thoughtful work. And you know, if I think about the economy now, when will we really be able to get some traction to the upside? As we were saying earlier, it's not imminent. It's not happening right away, even if everybody goes outside tomorrow. Technically, the recession may shortly end, but it doesn't mean we're back to normal. This is where the good leading indexes come in. If they can put together a pronounced, a pervasive, a persistent rise, then that signals that things will be ready to really start turning. We're not there today.
I want to come back to your earlier point about exogenous shock factors and how they play in, because as you pointed out, a lot of times the recessions, and I would say the biggest and most important recessions, even the 1929, the beginning of the Great Depression, there was really no exogenous shock there. That was an overcooked economy that was just too heated up, and it was time for gravity to set in. I would argue that the same thing is really true of 2008. We had a whole lot of just pent-up, overpriced financial assets. The subprime debacle and what happened in housing was kind of you could think of it as a shock, but it was really part of the process. It was part of the overvalued financial asset. It wasn't some, you know, war that started or some external thing. Now, what seems ironic to me, Locke, is if I think about, okay, so where is there an analog to the current situation where there was a major exogenous event, where all of a sudden everything changed because of something that had nothing to do with the financial system that nobody anticipated was coming? Well, World War II comes to mind, but ironically, in a lot of ways, World War II ended the Great Depression. So how do we make sense of you know, clearly this particular crisis is an exogenous shock event. It's about the virus. It's not about, you know, whether or not commercial paper was overvalued before it started. It's about the fact that we had to shut the whole economy down. What do we learn from other cycles that tells us how this might be different from other recessions?
So, well, I'm thinking I'm jumping around in history now over the past century, but certainly, you know, the Depression, as you said, overcooked, financially related shock to, I would say, combines with the endogenous cyclical forces. Okay, what the leading indexes are trying to pick up, which is much broader than what's going on in the markets. And of course, in the Great Recession, also, you know, those some of those financial failures and things we were talking about coming at a time when there was vulnerability, cyclical window of vulnerability. So it's the combination of the two that give you the recession. When Pearl Harbor, you know, that's like kind of the big shock, right, out of left field. When that occurs, the leading indexes were actually ramping up. So the window of vulnerability isn't there. And to your point, it helps drag us out of that earlier depressionary situation. In 1990, you know, Saddam invades Kuwait. It's not the end of the world for any, you know, the U.S. or anything, right? We get a spike, a little spike in oil prices, but that ends up being a recessionary event. And so here, actually, going into the coronavirus pandemic, the cyclical indexes were starting to turn up. They weren't running away, but they were starting to turn up. And you even see some of the PMI data at the beginning of the year following suit and starting to firm a little bit. And then it gets walloped by, you know, the biggest shock that we've been all living through with the virus and the mandated kind of recessions through the shutdown. Now, it's kind of interesting, though, because, you know, I don't know if I would go as far as to say that this is a black swan event. You know, I was listening the other day to Taleb, Nassim Taleb, you know, who coined the term, right? Black swan, as far as I know. And you know, he cautions not to, you know, just use that term as a cliche for any bad thing that surprises us. You know, from you've heard all the stories of various people, including him and Navarro in the White House and others saying, hey, you know, this is Bill Gates, everybody saying that, you know, this is a real issue here. We got to get in front of it. I think Taleb phrased it as, you know, you should kill it in the egg. You know, we got to jump on this, but it didn't happen. When I look separately from all of that, from all the viral analysis, back at ECRI's research, our leading indexes turned down, they started to weaken in January. Okay. And that's around the time that Navarro was privately talking inside the administration about the risk. And Taleb was saying what he was saying, and Gates was saying what he was saying, all from different vantage points. Okay. Totally different measures of vulnerability or of threats or of risk. And so it's complicated, right? We've got to, by definition, watch out for things that are going to surprise us. And we also have to have, I think we don't have to, but I think it's a good idea to have some sort of framework, some sort of way of getting your bearings. And, you know, everybody, I'm not dissing any other approach to getting your bearings, but I think on this kind of directional analysis of where free market activity is going, you know, I'm quite sold on a cyclical framework. I've always thought, you know, I really minimally want to know which way to look. I'll worry about magnitude second, and then that's not really the strength of the cyclical indicators. But which direction should I be looking? Even though it sounds crazy, and I'm not pushing back on your original objection, that while technically the recession could end this summer, we're not getting back to normal soon, I still know the direction I'm starting to look. I don't think it's going to be a big V for all of the reasons everybody's been talking about. I really need to see where the leading indexes are going to be heading to see how durable the recovery is going to be. And much of it may depend on the epidemiology of what happens here.
Locke, talk to us about how you see this playing out from here. I know you've written about a so-called bullwhip effect that comes into this, but in general, what should we expect in terms of a roadmap of what cycles teach us about what to expect from here to an eventual recovery?
Yeah, great question. That's where we're spending all of our time. We certainly are watching the high-frequency leading indicators, and some of them, maybe if you squint, are trying to find a bottom here. The weekly leading index has kind of been bouncing at a very low reading, but not at all plunging the way it was earlier. Some of our global sensitive industrial material price measures, so we look at things that are very early in the production chain. And those, again, have obviously been crushed, but they seem to be starting to try and bottom. So when we look at those types of high frequency data and, you know, possible bottomings in that data, we really have to look at what's going on globally. It's much bigger than the US. And here, one of the dominant factors, especially in larger cyclical moves, is what we call the bullwhip effect, where the farther away you are from the end consumer, the larger the amplitude of your cycle. And so this means, like, you know, so if someone in New York City is buying something just, you know, on the street, they're the end consumer, but it could ripple all the way back to some early input commodity in an emerging market where a small cycle in New York is a massive cycle in the emerging market. This is originally just to give credit to the origins of this concept. It's a colleague of my mentor, Jeffrey Moore, who was a woman named Ruth Mack, and in the 1950s wrote a paper about the shoe, leather, and hide sequence. And so, you know, shoes being the kind of front-end consumer, you go to buy a shoe, leather is kind of that intermediate input, and hides is the very early commodity, and often with kind of a relatively fixed supply, right? Because there's so much. In this case, hides are produced, you know, they're a byproduct of meat production. But you could imagine semiconductors or oil, right? You have this big investment in the production, and you're going to produce, and the prices swing massively as a result when the bullwhip gets into effect. So what we've seen isn't a modest downshift in consumer demand. We've seen a collapse in the current cycle, and that's amplified up the supply chain. And even more, like the supplier to the supplier is just getting, you know, I almost feel sorry for these guys because they're just getting crushed. For example, China, despite signs of a modest domestic rebound, the collapse in globally in end consumer demand, right, as a result of the virus, is boomeranging back on the Chinese economy now because it's reverberating right up the supply chain. So they can restart and say, oh, we got some back orders and we're going to, you know, start to fill those and whatnot. But they are going to have a tsunami of like collapse in demand hit them. And that's starting to happen now. And so you see their exporters are already seeing the orders nosedive very recently, and the worker layoffs and all that is cranking up. So this global recession is China's one example. I think commodity prices are another great example. The production, as I suggested, tends to be relatively inelastic. And so when the demand is collapsing, the prices are just like the moves there are just incredible. We saw oil, for example, right? That was about as big a collapse as you could see. It starts off in a fight between Russia and Saudi Arabia, you know, and then their storage capacity. But at its root, the collapse in the price is really about a massive bullwhip effect, which is just crushing it. Now, we track these oil prices, other exchange traded prices, and they, as you know, got crushed. And then we also track these non-exchange traded inputs. And those have also, they kind of hung in a little longer than the exchange traded commodities, but then they also really collapsed. And just recently, they're just starting to maybe find a floor. So this may be the kind of trough in the bullwhip effect, but the numbers are just going to be really dramatic for early exporters like, you know, China and some of the other Asian economies and commodity driven economies. And currently that's just crushing, you know, that'll really knock the air out of inflation and other things for the time being. Now at some point, and this again is where the leading indexes come in, the bullwhip will flick the other way. It works both ways. Okay. And this is another reason why I don't want to belittle necessarily the technical end of the recession, even though we are nowhere near recovered and will be. Just because the recession ends doesn't, you're going to have millions of people unemployed. It's not going to be a good economy. But these directional shifts can support a flick of the bullwhip the other way. And so we have to keep an eye out for that with the leading indexes.
Locke, last time we had you on the show, one of the things we talked about was the Japanification of the U.S. economy and really more so the monetary system and low bond yields and lots and lots of quantitative easing and so forth. Now, in recent months, a trend that I've seen with a lot of our expert guests on this program is where it used to be just, you know, people would laugh you out of the room if you even mentioned secular inflation. What they're saying now is it's not quite time yet. You know, they're saying, hey, we're still got a deflationary backdrop, but, you know, you're right. It's on the horizon. It's coming. We're going to get to the point with all of this fiscal spending and all of the monetary intervention that's occurred. Eventually, it all has to become inflationary. And I'd say probably the consensus among our guests is, first of all, they don't know. But if they have to guess, they think maybe it's about 3 years off before we get a major shift out of deflation into inflation or stagflation. What do economic cycles and the study of cycles teach us that might help us to navigate that path as we figure out where we are on this voyage towards eventually getting out of deflation?
A huge question. Huge question. You know, they always talk about the bond investors being the smart guys. You know, they certainly, ECRI over decades, we have a lot of fixed income and global fixed income managers use cycles. And the equity guys can get caught up in the stories, right? Like right now, it's all the tech stocks, and you've got to chase those and so on and so forth. And those are really good stories. I understand them. But this is a huge question. We've been talking about the decline in trend growth for over a decade. It was in the summer of 2008 that we started talking about this, way before Larry Summers and all that discussion a few years later. And there's structural problems that are holding down growth, and it relates to demographics and productivity growth and on an aggregate scale. And those things haven't gone anywhere. And so prior to this recession, you saw what seemed like unthinkable amounts of growth in debt, public and private, in order to get, you know, what was kind of like okay growth in the economy. I think the growth in debt, this is pre-crisis, pre-COVID crisis, the growth in debt of like the US, Europe, China, Japan was 10 times larger than the growth in the economy. So it gives you an idea of, like, you know, where the growth in the economy was coming from. And the U.S. was the least dirty shirt in that group for much of that time. But we were kind of doing the same thing, going with this debt expansion in various policy ways or corporate debt or whatever in order to pursue growth. And under the condition of low productivity growth and low demographic growth, that's our structural challenge. How do we have growth with those facts on the ground? And we were getting it, and the rest of the world is getting it through debt growth. Now you come into this brutal recession, US and globally. And boy, oh boy, there's been a lot of debt growth. So as everybody is saying, hey, this can't last. At some point, this is going to cause some inflation in terms of, you know, currency terms inflation, right? And maybe it's a few years out there. I think that's a, you know, a reasonable, sober thing to say. I wouldn't disagree with that, but I know a couple of things from cycles. One is that cycles in inflation are totally distinct and different than cycles in growth. And this is, it sounds easy to say that, but my gosh, you know, central banks globally are set up differently than what I just said. And, you know, it was only for a brief period in the 1990s when the U.S. Fed actually acted that way, where they recognized the difference between cycles and inflation and growth. Now, if we fast forward a couple of decades to the middle of 2016, our leading indicators of inflation, okay, they're separate from our leading indicators of growth. So most people don't even think about the world this way. But we're tracking a separate set of cycles in inflation. And globally, our leading indicators of inflation directionally turned up. And if you recall back then, inflation expectations that summer were on the floor. And then we had this inflation trade that occurs subsequently following that inflation cycle upturn. Now, it was not a big upturn. It was just a directional turn. Okay, and the direction, it was a big deal because everybody had been looking the other way. It wasn't big in terms of magnitude of inflation. And now, in the current cycle, we're still watching the inflation indicators. They're all falling. There's no inflation imminent. The one, you know, everybody listening has heard everything about it from every economist, but I'll try to boil it down to what I think is the one truism in economics, which is that recession kills inflation. And so I think you can kind of bank on that here. But what about a few quarters from now, or a few years from now, as other guests have opined? That's where these leading indicators of inflation come in. If they turn up, and I'm not going to predict the predictors, but if they turn up, then you have to deal with directionally higher inflation. Structurally higher inflation may be more difficult to come by, but you know, unless you're investing for decades, that may not be the call. Everybody has to kind of perform in the next quarter or two or three, and that, on that, that's much more of a cyclical time frame. So if there's a cyclical upturn inside of a secular disinflation, you still have to kind of deal with it and maneuver for it. I think that with the global recession that you have, you certainly have continued kind of low inflation for the time being. That's not over.
I'd like to move on to a final topic, which is, I think, one of the biggest, longest-term cycles that's known in economic research is the East-West power cycle, which, as I understand it, runs about every 500 years. Now, a view that I've held for more than a decade is that the U.S. and China were in the early stages of a Cold War that I think is going to go to the same proportions as the U.S.-Soviet Cold War. And, you know, I think that this crisis could very easily be the catalyst to ratchet things up quite a bit. So far in my coverage of the coronavirus crisis, I have avoided all of the conspiracy theories and ideas that it's a bioweapon and so forth. I just don't want to talk about it because I can't prove any of that. Just this last week, I saw the first, what I consider to be really credible evidence that this was lab-made. No evidence that it's a weapon, but that this was lab-made and very, very likely an accidental leak out of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Ironically, probably because they were doing research that was bought and paid for by Americans. But it looks like it probably did come out of a laboratory. And boy, what a hotbed of finger pointing. I mean, if the U.S. is going to say, look, it's all China's fault, China's going to say, you hired us to do this research, it's all your fault. Where does this go? And what do cycles teach us about escalation in major Cold War types of conflicts between nations? Is this the kind of catalyst that could really ratchet things up?
Well, I mean, it certainly moves the ball down the playing field a little quicker than you might have expected. I don't know if we're at the end zone just yet. But on this road to Japanification, for example, which isn't even about necessarily China directly, you know, we've accomplished in a few months this year in 2020 what would otherwise may have taken us, you know, a handful of years or more in terms of the debt growth and some of the other things that have occurred to the economy in terms of the downside damage. So things have certainly accelerated. And when our economy and other economies, China's economy, become more precarious, there's all kinds of political pressures that are going to pop up. I'm going to get my timing is, I've kind of lost track of time during this, during being sequestered here, but it was roughly a year ago, I would say, that Vice President Pence gave a very important, I thought, very clear speech on China and the U.S. Attitude, you know, or not our attitude, the near term, the midterm, and the longer term kind of issues that as a superpower, the U.S. has with China rising as a superpower. And none of that is going away, and it probably, as you're saying, gets accelerated during this time of great flux, right? Everybody's untethered, so those kind of things can accelerate quickly in that kind of environment. You know, I don't know the details of the origins or the facts. I think it's hard about the virus and where they came from. But I've been, one of the other books I've been kind of starting to look through is Bob Shiller's Narrative Economics. So it may not, what actual literally happened may be less important compared to the narrative that takes hold here. And that's going to take hold in the context of the geopolitical tug of war that's going on. A couple of years ago, we did a report, which I'll give to you so listeners can look at it, about the century-long kind of flow of wealth east and west. And so the West, the rise of the West, you know, really comes with industrialization, you know, the Industrial Revolution in Europe, and then the and colonialism. These are two huge things that where the West can, you know, really dominated the world. I think it's in the middle of the last century, like in the 50s or so, the West is dominating the entire globe, and the U.S. is most of the West, right, at that point. And are the majority, we were the really big player. Ever since then, it's been kind of slowly swinging back the other way until the last couple of decades where that's accelerated. We're still the biggest. The West is still bigger, but the kind of swing of the pendulum back has accelerated a bit further when you talk about the kind of the centuries view of this. And you know, so that does get a little exciting, right? When you're a global superpower, as the U.S. is, you're the military dominator of the world, yet this is still happening. Largest market, most productive market, all of those things. Yet the pendulum is still, just by dint of, you know, for lack of a better word, physics, kind of swinging back a bit.
How do you even look at something like this? It seems to me there's a conundrum here, which is you'd think, okay, let's look at economic cycles history and what it teaches us about Cold Wars and major rifts between nations and so forth. But, you know, all the history on that stuff goes back to a time period before globalization. So when you had the U.S. and the Soviet Union not being friends with one another, neither one was dependent on the other for most of its export business. But now with China, it's a completely different story. And I don't think there is a historic precedent for this situation. What do you do in that case?
You literally just hit on a report that we're doing right now, which is, look, stock prices are related to cycles. There is a relationship. You can't literally time stock prices on it, but they're related to them. And stock prices will typically bottom in the vicinity of a business cycle trough, especially true in the United States. What's interesting is when you look internationally, let's say UK, Germany, France, China, Japan, any of these big countries. Now, when you look there, that's not actually the rule. And the reason is because we're so interdependent. Global investors have bought a lot of the U.S. I mean, they're invested here. There's nothing innocuous, there's nothing insidious about it. They want to invest in what's a good bet, and they're buying U.S. companies, right, as shareholders. And what happens is you end up seeing international equity markets have a very tight relationship. They're tethered to the U.S. market, which is tethered to the U.S. economy. So as you're suggesting, it's harder to say us and them because we're interinvested with each other quite a bit. And when you look at markets abroad, it's really about the domestic economy is maybe 50% of the equation, of the risk equation on equities. And the other 50% is what's going on with the U.S. That's where that risk equation gets really fuzzy, that you cannot divorce yourself from the other country that easily. And you see that even happening now in some of the issues that Vice President Pence brought up about the relationship between the U.S. and China near term, the short term stuff, the trade stuff that we're doing, right? Even right there, making some shifts just because of the interdependence, it becomes, you know, it's not straightforward, right? We've all been talking about this for a few years now. So to be continued for sure. But I think ultimately there's an aspect of us all being in the same boat.
Locke, before we close, I know that ECRI publishes some indices which are very widely followed, extremely popular with analysts. Tell us a little bit about what you guys do at businesscycle.com, what people can find on the website, and particularly the indices that you publish.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So, yeah, businesscycle.com is where everything is presented. And we freely have been releasing something called the Weekly Leading Index. My mentor, Jeffrey Moore, created the original Leading Index. And, you know, this is half a century ago. And in the 80s, developed something called, we distributed it through Business Week magazine back then. It was a really big deal. And it was the Business Week Leading Index. And then we took it private. And we just give it away to everybody on our website. And it's a very prompt leading index of U.S. economic cycles. And as I mentioned during the interview, it looks like it's trying to bottom here. And it's so prompt that every Friday we have it through the previous week. So this Friday we'll have it through, you know, it'll be through the end of April. And you get a really quick read on what the cyclical drivers of the economy are objectively saying, right? Because who knows? The market goes up, the market goes down. Do you believe it? You know, what was it? These are a lot of non-market related indicators also in there. So you have kind of a one-armed economist, you know, instead of saying on the one hand, on the other hand, it's just, it is what it is. It's either going down or going up, and looks like it stopped going down. So we want to keep a really close eye on it right here.
Well, Locke, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Locke. You know, the part that resonated with me, which is my whole argument all along, everyone's so getting so excited about the fact that they're going to reopen the economy. I mean, we had a hard shut off of the economy. It's impossible for the numbers not to start to improve once they start reopening things. But the bigger question is, how long does it take for us to even get remotely close to where the economy was even just 3 months ago before this whole thing started? And, you know, his analogy of trying to start up a stalled engine is really the way I look at it. It's like it will eventually start up again, but I think everyone's getting their hopes up in terms of how fast a recovery can come about. What did you take away from the interview?
I agree exactly with what you said, Patrick. And when we get to the COVID-19 pandemic update later in this segment, I'll have more to say about the reasons I don't think that we're going to see a V-shaped recovery and why this could take a real long time before things are actually back to normal. I particularly was looking forward to getting Locke's perspective on the secular shift to inflation and how it plays out. It's just such an important question. And I'll continue with our other guests in future interviews to focus on that same topic. But I want to move on now, Patrick, to our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't registered your free account yet at MacroVoices.com. Just go to MacroVoices.com, look for the red button on the homepage that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, here on page 2 of the post-game chart book, I see you've got a chart of the June crude oil contract. My favorite chart. What's on your mind?
Eric, all I just wanted to show was on that June contract, the recovery that we've seen off of that $5 printed low. We can't even use the continuous contract because it's got that minus 40 print on it. And it's been quite a bit of a recovery. Certainly interesting to see your thoughts as to what happens next here. So I wanted to start by asking you, though, to clarify something you've said many times, that contango in the futures market is a proxy for and therefore a measure of the demand for storage in Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, contango refers to a difference in price where the latter delivery month is priced higher than the near delivery month. What does that have to do with the demand for storage?
Well, let's take a look at page 3, which is showing you at a particular moment in time. This is as of yesterday's close on May 6th. Each one of those little yellow dots is showing you the price of each separate contract. So the bottom dot is the June contract. The next dot up is the July contract, August, September, October, and so forth. all the way out to 2029. The crude oil futures literally trade 10 years worth of future prices. We're really only looking at the front of the curve there. That difference in price, well, what does that have to do with storage? The easiest way to understand this is put yourself in the shoes of someone who owns physical crude oil that's in a tank in Cushing, Oklahoma, and their lease on that tank space is running out next month. They can't keep the oil there because they don't have storage after sometime, say, a few weeks from now. What are they going to do? Well, they've got to call somebody and try to buy some more storage space. They also have another option, though, that's available to them. What they could do is they could sell the June delivery contract, that's the bottom dot, and buy back, let's say for sake of argument, the December contract, which is about $4 higher right now in price. That would basically allow them to take the oil that they have in storage. They would be essentially selling it and then buying it back later. But they would pay a fixed price that's guaranteed. They can lock in that price of $4. They're going to get their oil back, but now they've got 4 months to find someplace else to store it. So effectively, what they did by selling their oil and at the same time buying it back for later delivery was they secured an indirect form of storage for that oil for the next 4 months. Now, that's not the way that people who need to store oil actually conduct their affairs. They're much more likely to call a broker who handles these storage tanks and leases and so forth and just directly rent some space from somebody who's got it. But because it's possible to do it that way, it creates an arbitrage where essentially the contango in the front of the WTI crude oil futures curve is a measure of the cost of storage, because one of the options for the way you could achieve storage of oil is selling your oil and buying it back, and the contango is effectively your storage cost. So that's what storage and contango have to do with one another. And the general rule of thumb is for the first 6 months or so of the WTI term structure, that's this chart on page three, the first six dots or so, what the primary thing is that's going to be affecting the distance vertical space between those dots is the demand for storage. That's the primary thing that determines that spacing. And the reason we got into a super duper deep super contango where there was, you know, $5 of space between the dots last month is because we literally were running completely and totally out of storage. Those dots are now much closer together than they were last month. That, at least on the surface, seems to be an indication that there's not nearly as much demand for storage as there was a month ago. Once you go past the first six dots or so, the rest of the curve really is more of a reflection of longer-term expectations in the market for the balance between supply and demand.
Okay, well, that covers the concept of what contango and backwardation means on any given day. But here's my problem with the chart on page three. It shows us all the different prices for all the different contracts as they were at one moment in time, as of yesterday's close, in this case, as of May 6th. But there was no actual time series in these charts. It doesn't show how this phenomenon of contango has been evolving throughout the entire crisis or over the past few months.
Well, Patrick, that's exactly the reason that I very, very seldom use this form of chart. I wanted to start with this chart because this format is basically the industry standard. It's what everybody uses. And the way that most people would show a change in term structure is on the same chart. They'd have one, you know, yellow line of dots like we see here, and then in another color, they would plot the term structure from a different date, from a different snapshot in time, and say, okay, you know, the yellow line is yesterday, and the green line is 2 weeks ago, and the red line is a month ago, and we look at the difference in shape, and maybe we can draw some conclusions from that. Even so, to me at least, this chart is just not a very effective way of thinking about what's going on, because if I look, let's say, at the bottom of page three, look at those dots, the first dot to the second dot to the third dot. Well, is the the first dot farther from the second dot than the second dot is from the third dot? Or is that space between the third and the second dot bigger than the space on the first? I can't tell. It's too hard just from looking at that chart. So I use my own form of chart, and that's on page 4. This particular format is kind of my own design. I haven't seen anybody else really think about term structure using this kind of chart. But what I'm doing is simply plotting each of those one-month time spreads, the difference between each of those individual dots. And I'm plotting that as a time series. So the white line here that you see is the difference between the June and the July contract. The green line above it is the difference between the July and the August contract. The orange line above that is the difference between the August and September contract. The yellow one is September to October, and so on and so forth. So by looking at it this way, what I can see is both the relative size of each of those one-month spreads. I can see how they're trending and where there's a difference in trend. If you look at, say, going back to the beginning of April, you see a very distinct phenomenon here where there's a general breakdown in the time spreads moving lower. But for the most part, the orange one, which is August, September, and the green one, which is July, August, they're kind of moving pretty much in the same direction, following the same signals. But the white one, which is June, July, is moving on a completely different trajectory. It's falling at a much steeper pace. So you can see a lot more and you can intuit more from this chart, at least in my opinion, in terms of what's happening. Now, I should mention also that the particular chart that I have here is only showing the actively trading spreads, starting with the June to July spread. The one before that, which was the May-June spread, the reason I had to take that off the chart is it literally, as it went into expiration, just utterly collapsed all the way. You know, this the Y scale here only goes down to minus $8 at the very bottom right. That May-June spread went all the way to minus $60 at one point just before it expired. So it wouldn't even fit on the chart here, Patrick.
Okay, well, this chart really drives the story home, but it seems to be completely at odds with a lot of what's been discussed here and predicted here on Macro Voices. For weeks and weeks, we've been discussing all the reasons why we would run out of crude oil storage and why it would cause these time spreads to drop like a rock. And we can clearly see that's exactly what was happening right up until April 21st when the pattern bottoms. But since then, it's been an uphill ride for these time spreads. And the look of things, we've retraced almost all the way back to those mid-March levels. Now, Eric, please help me understand here. If anything, it seems like the chart is showing it's pretty clear that the storage crisis is done and over with and having ended back on April 21st and that there's no longer a shortage of crude oil storage in Cushing, Oklahoma. Or maybe am I reading something wrong? What conclusions are you drawing from all of this?
Well, you're not reading the chart wrong. The chart is exactly telling you that. It's basically saying, hey, the storage crisis is over, baby. The contango is coming out of the market. Seems like something changed and everything is better now. And it is entirely plausible that that is an accurate explanation. I put out the feelers last week for our listeners in the physical crude oil market. I got several emails from people saying, hey, the pace of shut-ins that's happened ever since that May contract debacle with the negative prices. That freaked everybody out. All the people that were on the fence, not really sure what to do, they went ahead and made their decisions to shut in. So we really are seeing en masse shut-ins of production that is dramatically reducing that demand for storage. So it is possible, I emphasize possible, that this could be it. It could be that, the price signal worked. It freaked everybody out. It caused the producers to shut in, and we no longer have a major contention for storage space in Cushing, Oklahoma, which certainly is what this chart appears to be telling us.
Hold on. You just explained last week that you thought a smaller inventory builds in both Cushing and nationally were being misinterpreted, and that seems very relevant to this discussion. Now, please explain again and give us an update on whether you still think that's what's going on here.
Well, what I predicted 2 weeks before it happened, back when we were getting 15 million barrels of national builds and 5 million barrels of Cushing builds, I said, I think what's happening and I think what's coming is going to be a much smaller Cushing build, maybe even a Cushing drawdown. And everybody's going to assume it means, okay, there's no more demand for storage. The storage crisis is behind us. In fact, it could mean that. It's possible that that's exactly what it does mean. But it's also possible that the reason, you know, think about a glass of water. If something is already full, you can't add more to it. If Cushing is as full as it can get, and there's no room to put any more oil in because there's nobody who's willing to lease any spare storage capacity at any price, well, then the size of the builds have to get much smaller or even go to zero because there's no room to add any more. It doesn't mean that there's no demand. It just means that there's no room to add any more. Now, Patrick, my first thought was that phenomenon I predicted is in play. What we're seeing is smaller Cushing builds. The reason for the smaller Cushing builds is probably because there's no space left at all, and oil cannot be added. It has to go into much more expensive floating storage instead, and the market's taking it the wrong way, and that has caused the beginning of a short squeeze, because perhaps the most crowded trade that there is in the oil market has been short time spreads. Lots and lots of big traders, short time spreads in size. They've had to start covering. It's caused a short covering rally or a short squeeze where everybody's being forced out. And I thought maybe that's based on a false signal. Well, the way you would validate that is to look at the tanker charter rates. If tanker charter rates are going through the roof, well, that means that, yeah, it's exactly what I thought. The reason for the smaller Cushing builds is because it all has to go into floating storage. It doesn't fit into Cushing, and the market's got the wrong signal. So let's go ahead and take a look at page 5, which is showing spot tanker rates in the VLCC market, the very large crude carrier market. And I went and looked at this chart thinking, if this is going to a new high, that really confirms my thesis. Well, guess what? Not only is it not going to a new high, it's crashing back to levels not seen since February. And I thought, oh boy, if we're seeing the tanker market also reflecting a sudden drop in demand, maybe that means that we really and truly are past that peak in storage and we don't have demand for storage anymore. It was one of our listeners who pointed out to me on Twitter, he said, wait a minute, Eric, you're looking at the demand for spot storage of tankers. That's where the OPEC guys that are delivering oil from point A to point B, that's where they buy their tankers. But the tanker trade, the contango trade, where you're storing oil by chartering a tanker for 6 or 12 months to just sit at anchor and hang on to the oil and come back and deliver it later, that's a different market. That's the time charter market. That's a different chart. And that one is on page 6. So all of a sudden, we see on page 6, wait a minute, that number's coming down. Well, first of all, why did the number on page 5 come down? The reason it came down is because OPEC's production cuts went into effect May 1st. That means OPEC countries are using less of those delivery tankers to deliver oil. Those prices are coming down. Well, if those prices are coming down, that means there's more tankers in the ocean that are available to be hired for something. It only makes sense that that has to cause the time charter market to come down too. Did it come down just as much or not quite as much? Well, it really, if you look at page 6 here, it didn't come down nearly as much. So I'm kind of on the fence here, Patrick. I think there is still room for the interpretation that what has happened here is there's been a short squeeze in time spreads that has pushed both the time spreads and the flat month price higher. It's being driven by this perception that we don't really have a storage problem anymore, that the demand for floating storage is collapsing, which if you looked at the first chart on page 5 showing tanker rates, you'd come to that conclusion. If you look at the page 6 chart, though, which I want to thank that listener for pointing this out to me, it really tells a very different story. So I think the jury is still out here. There's definitely room to conclude that what's going on is we've seen a short squeeze in both front month price and in time spreads. May have topped today, just as I look at the chart as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. It looks like a reversal may be upon us in both the flat price of the June contract and in time spreads. But hey, this is, you know, we're at the point in this crisis. In the beginning, I was super high conviction. I'm like, folks, I know exactly what's going to happen. I'm sure of it. Well, we're at the hard part now where it's, you know, I see a couple of scenarios. I think you could interpret this either way. But my base case, if I have to say what I think is most likely, I think this thing's overdone. I think at least part of this has been a short squeeze. Maybe we do have less demand. We're past the peak for demand and storage because there's been so many shut-ins of production. Very, very possible. We've got lots of evidence to corroborate that that is going on. But is the demand for storage really almost gone completely away, as the chart on page 4 seems to imply? Now, I don't think so. I think what's happened is some of it's gone away. It started a short squeeze. That short squeeze has had to play out, may have topped out today. And it remains to be seen, Patrick, how this ultimately plays out.
So, Eric, it remains to be seen how this all plays out here. But what are the signposts? What are we looking for how this all gets resolved?
Well, for that, we need to go back to page 4 in the slide deck. Now, you mentioned earlier, you said that it looks like the storage crisis appears from this chart to have ended on the 21st of April. Actually, if you look a little more closely at the graph on page 4, you'll see that it's the June-July contract, the white line, that bottoms on the 21st of April. But really, all the other later spreads, the green one is July, August, and the orange is August, September, and so forth, they all bottomed on the 28th, not the 21st. So what's special about the 21st? That's the question you have to ask. Why did the June-July spread go so far down on the 21st? And furthermore, look at how steep it declined into the 21st. It was really only in those last few days from the 16th of April to the 21st that it just took an absolute nosedive. I mean, it was on a downward trajectory before, but it was kind of in line with what the spreads above it were doing. And then on the 16th, it just took an outright nosedive. Now, this chart doesn't even do justice to how big of a nosedive that was, Patrick, because intraday on the 21st, this spread actually traded all the way down to minus $12. It would be well off the bottom of the scale here. This chart is only showing closing prices on the end of each day. So it just shows you minus 710 or so, which is where that spread closed on the 21st. But it was in absolute free fall. What's so special about those dates, the 16th of April and the 21st of April? It's no coincidence, Patrick. The 16th of April was options expiration for the May contract, the one that came before this one, and the 21st was the last trading day for the May contract. So what happened is when, and we don't have it on this particular chart, but the May-June spread, it didn't just dive down to minus 12. It dove all the way down between the 16th and the 21st. It dove all the way down to minus 60. So why did that happen? The answer is, you know, you can play lots of games with sentiment and maybe gaming the inventory numbers a little bit. It's been suggested that some of the big players may have been leasing storage in Cushing and intentionally leaving it empty to make sure that Cushing never hit the actual full mark as far as the EIA reporting was concerned, trying to kind of confuse the market a little bit and muster some positive sentiment that might not actually have been warranted by the true underlying conditions. But the thing is, when you get to the contract going into expiry from options expiration to the actual final trading date, that's when the fat lady sings, so to speak. That's when you find out whether or not there's an imbalance between the number of physical shorts that are standing for delivery, that are going to actually deliver oil as opposed to rolling their paper contracts forward, versus the number of physical longs, people who are able to actually receive delivery as opposed to paper traders who have to roll out of that position. That's when the fireworks really start, and that's when you can't really hide reality from the market. So The answer is, I don't know. It could be that the storage crisis really is mostly behind us. I'm very, very skeptical of that. I find it very hard to believe. If I'm right, it would be into options expiration, which is next Thursday, the 14th of May, would be when the fireworks start. And by the 18th or 19th of May, the 19th Tuesday, is the last trade date for the June contract. The 18th, Monday, is called the penultimate day, which is a great big Latin word that means the second to last one. Why they use that fancy word, I don't know, but that's what they call it. The second to last trading day is usually where everybody has to get out of the market, because the last day is really only for the physical traders to finalize their transactions. So by the end of the 18th, we're going to know one way or the other. If on the 18th, we see basically the backwardation on the June-July spread, which on this chart is showing one spot 24. Let's say it's still less than $2 as of Monday the 18th. Okay, look, folks, I guess I was a little bit late on the call. The storage crisis, it's behind us. It's getting better. It's time to start thinking about how you play the upside of the oil market from here. I think it's more likely that we're going to see some more downside before we get to the 18th, maybe a lot more downside. But really, we don't find out until we get past OPEX, which is next Thursday.
And needless to say, we'll have another update for our listeners on next week's Macro Voices, which we'll be recording just a few minutes after the pit close on the OPEX day. Until then, it sounds like the message is to watch for a possible downside reversal, and maybe a big one, on both time spreads and the front month price. Is that the gist of it?
Exactly. And again, I am hearing feedback from some of our listeners in the physical market saying, hey, the rate of shut-ins is just scary. It could be that this is real. The demand for storage has abated significantly because a whole bunch of people were forced to shut in. It could be as simple as that. I have a really hard time believing that the storage crisis is over already, despite what these charts are telling us. And, you know, we'll find out. Certainly by the end of the month, that will be it. In the interest of full disclosure, I just want to mention, I have exited most of my time spread shorts last Thursday and Friday, as I described on last week's podcast. Even though I didn't think the move made sense, I thought it was set to continue. I was right about that. I was fortunate to get out of the way. I did put some of those time spread shorts back on today, thinking maybe this is the top today of a short squeeze. But that's a much smaller position, much less leverage than I was using before, because I'm really not sure of it this time, where I was pretty darn sure the last time around. So we'll see what happens. Overall, though, I don't know if it's time yet for us to start thinking about buying the bottom of this market and, you know, how to play the recovery from here. Maybe there's one more push down, but, you know, if it's one more push down, pretty soon, if we haven't already seen the bottom, we're going to get to a bottom, and it's going to be time to look at how you buy the bottom of this market. And I don't think it's with USO or any of the other ETF products, which are very vulnerable to the contango at the front end of the curve. The way to play that is with time spreads further out on the back end of the curve. Let's save that conversation until we get there, until we think that we're actually past that point. Could be as early as next week's episode. We'll see.
So, Eric, let's move on and get an update from you on what's going on with the COVID-19. What's new?
Well, Patrick, until now, I have very consciously and intentionally avoided any mention or discussion of the conspiracy theories. You know, it was a bioweapon engineered in order to intentionally take out humanity, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's just every imaginable conspiracy theory on the internet. I think those are, you know, things that should be investigated. We should ask every possible question. But until now, I hadn't seen any compelling evidence to support any of these ideas, and I didn't want to touch them because without compelling scientific evidence, I don't think it's useful to speculate in wild conjecture about what somebody's motive might have been for a bioweapon or what have you. And I want to be clear, I still have not seen any evidence that suggests that this is a bioweapon that was engineered to be a bioweapon. Again, I think that kind of thing should be investigated just in case, but I still have not seen any evidence that that's what's going on. What I did see for the first time this week, and we've got some videos linked in your Research Roundup email, was Chris Martinson did a piece, and it really does appear that the Wuhan Institute for Virology was doing research on what's called gain of function, which means intentionally taking viruses out of animals and trying to see if you can monkey with their RNA and get them so that they will be capable of infecting humans. Now, I know it sounds like that would be a weapon thing to be researching. There are valid reasons that they do this kind of research, just to research, you know, how viruses spread and so forth. It's called gain of function testing. And it's something that apparently was going on with bat viruses. Now, here's the crazy part. You've heard a lot of reports in the media saying, look, leading scientists, experts in this field, have all weighed in saying there's no evidence whatsoever that this thing was created in a laboratory. It's nonsense. Don't even pay attention to this. It's all crazy talk. The scientists, the experts have weighed in. What Chris Martinson's done is really looked in detail at this, and he's realized, look, there is this idea called gain of function research where they intentionally try to get these animal viruses modified in a way that they could infect humans so they can basically test what could go wrong. Not only did the Wuhan Institute of Virology get contracted to do exactly that kind of research on bat coronaviruses, the kind of virus that's in play here, and do gain-of-function testing to see if they can infect humans or be made to infect humans, but apparently they were funded to do that work by, bought and paid for, American science as far as I can see, American government grants. So they were doing this research, and furthermore, the people who sponsored that research, the people whose name is on the grant application to get the check from the U.S. government to pay the Wuhan Institute of Virology to do this kind of research on bat coronaviruses, are the same scientists that have been quoted in the media as saying there's no evidence whatsoever that this thing could have possibly been man-made. So there's a lot of conflicts of interest here. Now, I don't claim to know that Chris Martinson is right about all of this, but there's a particular video that he did. The first video that we have linked kind of gives the backstory of this. He didn't know the information in the second video when he produced the first video. The second video from a few days later is where Martinson finds out that there is a genetically inserted sequence of RNA in the SARS-CoV-2 virus that does not exist in any of the adjacent members of the family tree of this virus. There's a whole video to explain this whole thing. I don't want to get into all of the details in the podcast. The point is, it's the first time that I've seen really compelling evidence, not of a weapon, but apparently of gain-of-function research trying to take bat viruses that only infect bats, get them so that they can infect humans intentionally for the purpose of doing research and testing, and it looks like that leaked and probably is the source of this thing. He makes a very compelling case about why there's one specific question which nobody in the press has asked yet, and so he's encouraging them to ask it, which is how did this specific genetic insert get into the RNA signature of this virus if it was not from genetic editing that went on in a laboratory? Please explain how else it could be possible based on where the SARS-CoV-2 sits in the genetic tree and the fact that none of its adjacent branches of the tree have any signs of this particular signature. And there's another video that we don't have linked because it's even a day later, where he's found more information that it appears that there's some evidence that one of the reference cases of a different virus, it's a little bit dodgy as to why there's no records before the January 20th of 2020 for the existence of one of the things that they're saying might have been the natural source of this. It almost looks like somebody made up another virus to compare the SARS-CoV-2 virus to. I don't know if he's right, but this is the first time I've seen compelling enough evidence that it really appears to me that there's a strong case, not only that this was created in, I don't want to say that the virus was engineered out of nothing. It looks like it was a bat virus that infects other bats that was modified intentionally through gain of function research funded by the United States in order to make it so it could infect humans. It looks like that may be where this virus came from. Now, what are the implications of that, if it's true, in terms of U.S.-China relations? The U.S. is going to blame China. It's all their fault for sloppy, you know, they let this thing out. Maybe China would say, well, the U.S., you know, hired us to do their dirty work. Why did they want to do this research in the first place? I have no idea where this could go, but it just seems to me like it is a can of worms in terms of where this could take us. There's also more evidence coming out this week that, to me, just... it paints a more compelling picture that we're not headed for a simple scenario of a V-shaped recovery until there's a vaccine which solves the problem and it's all forgotten and gone with. First of all, there's very strong evidence of mutation of this virus into multiple strains. And what that means is you could potentially have gotten one strain, you develop the antibodies so that you're immune to getting that strain again, but there's other strains around, and maybe you could get another strain that you're not immune to. And so the fact that you've already had it doesn't really give you any protective immunity from the other strains that are in circulation. That means the whole concept of herd immunity as being sort of the solution that solves the problem eventually might be much, much farther off than we originally thought, because you'd have to develop herd immunity to all of the different strains that are in circulation, which is a very different story. Now, the other thing is, earlier in the coronavirus crisis evolution, it seemed like, fortunately, younger people, particularly children, were almost immune. They would contract the virus. They would be spreaders of the virus. A lot of school children gave the virus to their parents, it seems. But the kids never really got sick. They didn't have any serious symptoms. They just spread it around. Now what we're seeing is big outbreaks, first in London and now in New York City. And the doctors are questioning, okay, is this a mutation of the coronavirus that we know and have been dealing with for the last few months, and somehow suddenly now it does develop serious symptoms in children because it's a different mutation? Or could it be an entirely new pathogen? We don't even know that, but something's going on where all of a sudden kids are being affected. And of course, if kids are susceptible, that changes the practicality of restarting school. If you can't restart school, it's hard for parents to go back to work, because if they don't have daycare arrangements, it just has a ripple effect on the ability to restart the overall economy. So there's lots of reasons. The other thing I mentioned in one of the podcasts, I said there's never been a successful coronavirus vaccine. It was pointed out to me by a listener that that's wrong. There has been a successful coronavirus vaccine for camels, but never one for humans. So, you know, there's never been a successful coronavirus vaccine. Yeah, we got a lot more smarter people working on it this time. It certainly is the focus of the entire medical community's efforts. Probably there's a better chance of getting one this time, but it's not a done deal that there's going to be a vaccine. And if there is a vaccine, it's not a done deal that it's a vaccine for all of the different strains that are out there. It might be that we have a vaccine that only protects against, you know, half of the strains that are in circulation. So I think there's a very real chance, Patrick, that we continue for a period of several years. I don't mean in lockdown, but, you know, we restart the economy partially, and people who are most at risk, elderly and so forth, have to stay at home for an extended period of time. And we continue to have some degree of social distancing, where maybe, you know, big sporting events and stadiums full of people and everything doesn't become practical again for many years to come. So I don't think there's any reason to assume that there's a V-shaped recovery, and I don't think there's any reason to assume this is going to be easy. Obviously, we're going to make progress. Hopefully, the worst of this is behind us, but it doesn't mean that we're just a few months away from forgetting it and moving on. I think there's a lot of risk. And, you know, the other thing we haven't even talked about, there's bioterrorism risk at some point. The bad guys are going to think about how to use this stuff to hurt us. And if you think about the things that have happened with suicide bombers in the past, they had to get through the metal detectors with their bombs and their weapons and so forth. If your weapon is, you know, you're a martyr and you're willing to give your own life for your cause, and your weapon is your own body, you infect yourself with a deadly virus. As long as you can personally get to a political rally where you can shake hands and give people hugs and do whatever, you can do a lot of damage, and there's no way to detect that. The bad guys are thinking about this stuff already. You know that's going to be part of the future. So the consequences of this are really significant. We do have three Chris Martinson videos linked in your research roundup. First one is the background on why it might be lab-made. The second one is kind of the smoking gun evidence about this genetic insert. The science is over my head, but it seems like he makes a pretty darn compelling case that we need to answer this question of where did this specific insert come from, if not from a laboratory. And none of the people who have opined that supposedly, oh, there's no evidence that it's lab made, nobody's been able to answer that question or has even been asked to answer that question yet. There's another video that talks about multiple strains of COVID-19 and why there may be more than just one vaccine would be able to protect us from. You can decide from yourself whether or not his arguments are credible, but I think it's worth watching the videos. And Patrick, we're going to need to leave it there. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit MacroVoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's research roundup.
In this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the supporting articles for Locke's presentation and the charts we discussed in the post game. There's also an interesting article from Nouriel Roubini titled The White Swans of 2020, as well as a link to the latest Jeffrey Snyder installment of Eurodollar University 6 titled Shocking Fragility. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow us on our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric directly on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.